It's the last show of the year, and by tradition, we look back at the big stories of the past year. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Usually we have a journalist on with the idea that journalism is the first draft of history, but this time we hope to have a historian. Our phone number 1-800-478-8255 to join the conversation toll free. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. What the big stories were depends a lot on where you were, as we'll learn today on Talk of Alaska, statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
The Federal Subsistence Board meeting is Wednesday, January 21st through Friday, January 23rd, 2015 at the Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center in Anchorage. The meeting is open to the public either in person or by teleconference. Public comments and input on the proposed changes to federal subsistence fish and shellfish regulations is being sought, along with specific fisheries proposals. Meeting materials found at regulations.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, it wasn't too hard to come up with the top 10 stories of the past year. When I started, Professor Haycock, so glad to see you come in. Would you sit down over in that other seat, please? And cutting a little short, a little close there, buddy. Put your earphones on.
I said a bit before 10.
Yeah, right.
Terrific.
I'm joined by Professor Stephen Haycox, Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. And Steve, it's great to have you on the show again.
Well, thank you very much. If you want my official title, it's Distinguished Professor
Emeritus. Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm sorry, I left out the distinction.
Well, it's a nice honorific, but it's not important.
Yeah. So this also, I think, relieves you from the day-to-day pressure of having to have a whole lot of student load, right?
Well, yes and no. I do a course a semester, and you know, academics never get to quit if they're serious about it. It's pretty much the same. I had a very good friend who was a Superior Court judge here in Anchorage, and before he retired, we talked about retirement from time to time, and he was a little reluctant to retire, although he was eventually had to go because of the age limit.
Right.
And he said, why should I retire and do the same thing I'm doing now for less money and less power?
Yeah. But it's distinguished, though.
Well, yeah, and that's an interesting story. I was the first faculty member at UAA designated distinguished, and it's a wonderful honor. And usually there's an endowment that goes along with that, and mine was temporary. Our program that led to that was terminated eventually because of a loss of funding. But it's quite a wonderful honorific, and I'm proud of it and happy to wear it.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to have you back in here. For those who don't know, I will say you're author of a number of works, including Alaska and American Colony, and a new one, right, that's in draft now?
In draft right now. I'm working on a manuscript on Alaska's role in the rise of modern environmentalism, which is really an extended essay on the question of federalism. Are we really the victims of the federal overreach that we hear so much about rhetorically? And if so, why is that? And if it's not so, then why is it such a consistent platform on which our politics and our sense of state-ism, if you will, runs forward all the time?
You better hurry with that one, because I have a feeling things could be changing.
Well,
maybe that's one of the things we'll talk about.
One of the things we should talk about. You bet.
All right. So with that introduction, I think I'll go right through a list of what seemed to me to be the biggest stories, and it wasn't hard to find them. It's all in how you categorize them, basically, but like the elections was one. The elections, because we got a nonpartisan administration, which is like a political complete wild card, and it's going to be very strange. It's comparable, perhaps, Steve, with the ad hoc when that happened long ago.
Indeed. It's a shakeup of our politics. The Democratic Party had difficulty putting together a campaign that seemed to be attracting attention. That's a piece of the landscape where we are. We've been in a red oil state since the mid-1970s, of course. The ad hoc Democrat movement really did present the state with something new, I think, at the time, although it turned out not to be as different and as new as folks had anticipated it would be. They were sort of looking for...
Well, that's bound to happen.
It surely is.
But every reformer has that happen to him.
And I don't know that this constitutes a revolution either. But it's certainly something we haven't seen before.
Exactly. And, okay, so the along with that was the marijuana issue, which I think we will probably talk about. The Pebble Mine, which comes up as a different story, really, because of the 404C thing by the Environmental Protection Administration. And Mark Begich losing his Senate seat to Dan Sullivan, which is like has interesting prospects for the future in a number of different ways, including taking a powerful Democratic politician and putting him back into the mix for our future politics.
Quite so.
And we kind of, in a sense, luck out power-wise because we'll be with the party in power in the Congress in both sides of our delegation.
And former Attorney General John Havelock wrote about that before it happened. He said that if Begich doesn't get in, at least the lining on that cloud is that we'll be in the majority.
Yeah, and there it is. So another one that I know people in Ketchikan know about, but I'm not sure has been thought through as much, I'm sure you have, is the Ketchikan school funding court ruling.
Mm-hmm.
If this thing holds up, this is absolutely revolutionary because suddenly, and we're not the only state in which it has been, there's been a ruling that property taxes were an unconstitutional way of funding schools.
Indeed.
But in Alaska, it's a little different because the judge ruled on not equal protection, but on dedicated funds, which I can't even bring myself to think my way through, Steve. And I don't know if anybody else can either, except some lawyers right now.
Well, the lawyers are going to have a good time with that. I mean, what indeed is dedicated funding and what is not? And that's been a question that goes back. It's sort of been hanging out there waiting for somebody to tackle it, and Ketchikan tackled it. So we'll see where it goes.
Well, there was considerable pressure on other school districts politically not to join with Ketchikan in that lawsuit.
Yeah.
Now that it is decided... It's also pointed out, well, you know, it's only a couple of $100 million. In the scope of things, the amount of dipping we're going to do into the reserves anyway, this is kind of small potatoes right now.
It's a huge challenge. Both Roger Marks, the economist who formerly worked with the oil and gas projection team, and Clem Tillion, just in today's paper, have raised the question of is raiding the constitutional budget reserve and the statutory budget reserve the best way to try to get through this budget deficit. And then of course the elephant in the room hanging out there is how long does this go on? How long are oil prices going to be at $50? And when they go back up, as probably they will, how far up are they going to go? Are they going to go far enough up to really to put us back where we were, and that seems very unlikely.
Well, whatever happens out of that, there will be an alteration of the dynamics of the business. You can't take 40-odd percent out of the price and not have a change in the break point at which various things pencil out. Now, of course, the industry tries to think about 10 years ahead, but nonetheless, the little guys don't think that way. All these little stripper wells and the stripper wells all came back down in Texas, the North Dakota, tar sands in Alberta, suddenly don't pencil out anymore at this kind of oil price. And sooner or later, they're not all oil majors that can withstand that.
Indeed. And my experience has been, even though the oil industry has long-range planning, they tend to make policy on a quarterly basis on the basis of the next 6 or 9 months.
Notice that.
Yeah. And they pretty much have to. I mean, they can't put themselves the only one that's been able to do it, I think, is Exxon, which has a long-term development plan, 50-year, and they pretty much stick to that no matter what happens. But as you suggest, pretty much nobody else has been able to get away with that. And so they make judgments on a pretty short-term basis as a practical matter, it seems to me.
And that brings me to another of the big stories. So far we've had elections, the Pebble Mine, the Ketchikan School funding ruling, and then Chukchi drilling. And it's, you know, this popped up for the last 3 years in the top 10 stories. Year before last, or it was because of the Kulik went aground and everything like that. But those problems, it turns out, haven't gone away. And the game is stepping up. And even though there was no exact overt thing that happened, except for a little bit of policy juggling by the Obama administration, and there was a court ruling that questioned the validity of the actual lease sales that even gave those leases were bought. And we're talking like, I think $7 billion was put down for that lease sale.
We're on a frontier there. Former Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell, as you know, is really devoted a great deal of his time to thinking about future Arctic policy. And I don't think anybody knows really where it's going. I mean, the organization that Walter Hickel got started, the Arctic Council, a couple of years ago did adopt a search and rescue protocol, which pretty much all of the nations signed on to, but that's just the very bare beginning. And what is our development policy going to be out there? And what are the implications of people claiming the North Pole? And so what are the sovereignty issues? I mean, we're really on a pioneering frontier there, and I don't think anybody knows where that's going.
Wait a minute, now Denmark's saying it's ours.
Exactly.
Whoa, wait a second. I was expecting that. I thought it was going to be Russia.
Oh, I thought it was going to be Canada.
Whoa. No, I didn't think they had a chance.
Yeah.
We should have laid odds. Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is that there are still seamounts in the Arctic Ocean that haven't been found. Every once in a while, a boat will bang into one.
Indeed.
They didn't know it was there.
Indeed.
And they have to chart all that.
Yeah.
And they will be charting all that, and all that's going to take a lot of money.
Yeah, and there is indeed a geologic formation that runs out from eastern Canada right toward the North Pole. And the Canadians want to say, well, gee, as long as it's ours on the part that's not covered by water, it must be ours on the part that is.
But the problem is it goes all the way to Russia, and they say that too.
Just so.
Yeah, that one's going to be fun. And so long as we have brought that up, and we're speaking with distinguished emeritus professor of history, Stephen Haycox, and we welcome your calls, your observations about the big news of the past year at 1-800-478-8255. And I already did bring up the Pebble Mine there, so that kind of opens the door. People always want to call up and talk about that. But while we're at it, because we verged over when we talked about Chukchi drilling, and which includes the recent amazing plea agreement by Noble Drilling that wants to continue working for Shell, and has pled guilty to all sorts of serious problems with the way that they ran their vessels.
Mm-hmm.
It's been pointed out to me that the industry is not used to the kind of standards that they are being required to meet in the Chukchi, and that's part of the reason that they still try to do things business as usual. We saw this in the Deepwater Horizon also.
Yeah. The Alaska and the Arctic have always been a challenge on exactly those grounds. You remember the original pipeline design, the one that got thrown out, and that Rogers C.B. Morton had to kind of come in and repair the damage and come up with a reasonable plan, was exactly that. It was, well, we know how to build pipelines. We built them all over the rest of the world, so we'll just build another one here. And it simply was not going to work. And so that challenge has faced pretty much anybody who's done any development in Alaska and especially in the Arctic. you've got to learn to do it a new way.
I'm thinking all the way back to Copper River and Northwestern Railroad.
Indeed.
And the huge and immensely rich copper deposit there. But the problem was that you couldn't keep up the road and the railroad to go there. They had to replace those trestles every year.
Every year, the Copper River would take it out, and so they just got used to that.
They rebuilt
it every year.
But it also meant that you know, when economics changed and they found some richer deposits in South America and everything, they just dropped that thing.
Goodbye.
And there we are, Alaska, a colony again. You know,
they tried to sell it to the federal government, and even the feds wouldn't come up with the money that Morgan Syndicate thought they needed.
Well, now it's a national park. What do you know?
Indeed.
Welcome to the future.
Just so.
Public lands. Yeah, so, but so long as we're on the Arctic policy issue, Steve Haycox, we should really, looking ahead to the future, think about Alaska being part of the Arctic Council, the fact that Admiral Papp is in charge of Arctic policy for the administration, and that Fran Ulmer and Beth Gertula, two of the smartest politicians in Alaska, are working in the White House now.
Indeed.
And so things are changing in the Arctic policy front and will change in the coming year.
I think they definitely will. As I suggest, I think it's a frontier where the reference points aren't clear yet. And so it's very, very fluid, which on the one hand is a terrific set of challenges, but a marvelous set of opportunities. And aren't we fortunate to have people with background and with intelligence and with courage to be on the ground floor at the moment?
Yeah. So we lost Pete Rouse, and we got we got Beth Gertula and Fran Ulmer.
Yeah.
That's a very, very interesting political trade-off, and it's all pretty much behind the scenes right now.
It's
not
behind
being
the
talked
scenes.
About. Yeah.
But don't you love the games that fate plays?
I do. and where better than in Alaska to watch all this play out? You know?
Indeed.
You know, I mean, we're just a pair of senior citizens here, you know, sitting on the park bench and watching the people walk by in the village.
Indeed.
Okay, so I'll quickly blast through the rest of the top 10. We had elections, we had Pebble Mine, we had Ketchikan school funding ruling, Chukchi drilling, National Guard scandal, gay marriage, and its implication that it came to Alaska, I think, is the main thing there.
Just so.
Anchorage Daily News bought by a website, two troopers killed in Tanana, and this is like a recurring pattern we've had of our public safety personnel getting killed. And largely because of kind of goofy, suicidal, domestic kind of reasons. I mean, social pathology playing out in fatalities of first responders. It's not a good thing. And the appeals court ruling that hardly has been reported on at all, but it's got large implications, and that is that Native lands can now be put in federal trust and that the Interior Secretary intends to start doing that. And, of course, then they're not taxable. And while it's not Native corporation lands, it can be allotments and can be other things. And if there is a transfer mechanism for corporate lands, this could get really huge. And finally, the Flint Hills refinery was shut down by the Koch brothers up there in North Pole. So those were my top 10, Steve Haycox. And with that, I want to start the phone lines going, if it's all right with you. Okay, the phone number 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, toll free. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. We've already covered a lot of ground. We're looking back at the year past and looking ahead to the year to come, which just does seem like it's going to be interesting. And we get a James that joins the program from Juneau. James, thanks for calling.
Thanks for having. My question is as much looking ahead as it is looking back, and I was curious about your guest and what he thinks are the parallels between what's happening now with oil prices and the state economy versus what happened back in the mid-1980s when the bottom fell out, we started cutting costs, the big Susitna Dam project was a talk then, and then it disappeared when oil prices fell. I mean, is that going to happen again, or is this closer to the 99-2000 slump when that came and went? So I'm curious what you think, Professor Haycox.
Well, thank you for asking. Of course, as an historian, I do a much better job looking back than I do looking ahead. It seems to me that there's a difference from 85-86, and that is that in 85-86, there was still a lot more oil in the ground than there is now. So our situation here is complicated by how difficult it's going to be to get out what is still there. But of course, we are part of the warp and woof of the world economy on oil, and we don't have any control over what's going to happen to oil prices. So who knows? I was enmeshed in the university in 85-86, and with other state agencies, it was a bloodbath. Governor Sheffield told state agencies to submit to him three budgets, one with 5% less than their current budget, one with 10% less, and one with 20% less. And that was horrendous for people because it raised the possibility that 20% of your workforce was simply going to be lopped off. So is it going to be that bad here? I think we're not going to know until well into 2015 just how bad it's going to be.
And in the same way, here in Juneau especially, folks are worried that the cuts are going to be substantial, and that would have a major impact on Juneau's economy, much as it did back then in the 1980s.
And I guess you can all take some heart in the fact that nobody has said the inflammatory phrase capital move for quite a long time.
Well, and then, too, the Juneau Access Project, I don't think that was on your list of the big issues of the year, Steve, but definitely on the list of the Juneau Empire's top stories of the year, and I imagine it's on the minds of people throughout Southeast as much as it is in Juneau, because
you mean in terms of Walker of the year. In terms of Walker freezing it?
Well, and not just that, the state's been having meetings throughout Southeast about Juneau Access and the road, and I went to the ones in Skagway and Haines, and it was definitely on the minds of people there.
Yeah, that's a good example of what I was talking about. It, what the big stories are really depend on where you are, you know, because we haven't even talked about Chinook salmon, for instance. And for some people, that is no doubt the big story of the year and has been for a couple of years. Yeah, that's really interesting. Anything more there, James, from Juneau?
You know, I think also you can't miss it, but the weather, too, this year, it happens every year, but you know, this year has been especially odd with in Southeast. It was an exceptionally rainy summer, and now across the state, it's been an exceptionally warm winter. So I do think that odd weather has to be one of the top issues of the year, too.
Wow. Yeah. You're not getting an argument here. Haycox is nodding his head as well.
I had to drive through raindrops to get here this morning.
Oh. It's almost January.
It's right.
James, thank you so much for your call.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, 1-800-478-8255 is a telephone number. We're discussing what was the big news where you are. What were the top stories of the year? I got the list of the top 10 most viewed stories on our website. That's kind of interesting. Josh Edge has provided that. And I'll go through that in a second, but I want to repeat the phone number again, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. Always fun to do this year-end show. If nothing else, I like going back through the news, and there's all the stuff that I forgot, you know, that was sometimes is just plain weird. And sometimes it's quite noteworthy, and you say, wow, that, you know, often I'll start the process, and, you know, I'll say, well, there's only three or four big stories. And then after a while, I've got 17 or 18, I'm going to say, how am I going to narrow this down? And that is the way it goes, because it, over the period of a year in a state like Alaska, a lot of stuff happens, and the implications of these things are not necessarily foreseeable. But we try, especially on this last show of the year, we try to look into the crystal ball a little bit. So your call is welcome. Your input onto what you think the big news of the past year was. We barely touched on the Pebble Mine so far. But the top 10 stories by Web Hits were the Funny River Fire, number one. Probably should do this backwards, but I'm going to do it just frontwards and go down. The fishing vessel Arctic Hunter salvage. Now, think about that one. That was the one in Inukshak, I think, that sank and just kept burping out, and they couldn't. It took them forever to get that thing out of there. So that was one that people kept checking on because we were the only source for that information, us and KDLG. The earthquake swarm in the Brooks Range. Yeah, no attack quakes. All of a sudden, we started having earthquakes in the no attack. We had the state seismologist in here to talk about it. He says, yeah, this is unusual. We're going to have to put some instruments up there, see what's going on. But it's not that there weren't faults there, but they didn't know. And let's go ahead and get on through all these because they're great fun. Army Rangers train in Alaska's rugged interior. People just wanted to look at that story. When you get a lot of hits like that, it usually means people have been sharing because there's something about it that mm-hmm. That other people are interested in. National Weather Service issues El Nino watch. Mm-hmm. In an ad, Begich embraces his vote on Obamacare. Mm-hmm. FDA radiation monitoring program for salmon. It took them quite a while before they did it, and then they did it, and sure enough, people really wanted to know how that was coming out. The murder of broadcast personality Marvell Johnson was the number eight story in terms of web hits. He was well known. Both Steve and I knew Marvell, and it hit everybody here at the radio station really hard. The blue moon forecast. I love that. And the investigation attributes Coast Guard death to faulty equipment and work practices. Oh, yes, I remember that. It was out, I think that one was in Dutch Harbor.
Dutch Harbor.
Yeah. 1-800-478-8255 is the telephone number. 478-TALK. And it's a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Our local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. I had that right. An email, talk@alaskapublic.org. Joining the program from Cordova is Danny. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Danny.
Yes, good morning. I was surprised that the passage of SB 21 didn't get mentioned in the top 10.
Yeah, it was more the year before, but it was the repeal failing, I think, would be the issue this year, this past year, yes.
I see. Well, I think there's a lot of people, I've seen a lot of stuff on the web about what this is going to mean now. I think when it happened, everybody thought that the oil was going to stay at the price it was or go up, and all we were going to be discussing is how much new development we're going to have, and now everybody's scratching their heads wondering what it's going to mean at the $50 or $60 a barrel price, and whether they read it close enough to see what the implications were of that. And I don't know, I just feel like the public in general doesn't really understand it at those levels. And now that we're talking about budget cuts, I think a lot of people might have voted different or wonder what they really voted on. So that's all I wanted to bring up was the SB 21 and how all of a sudden, the biggest tax we have in the state is going to have implications going into the next couple of years.
I'm really glad you brought that up. I think that we can have Scott Goldsmith in here, who's got the model down on that from the Institute of Social and Economic Research, and he could show us what the model says about whether we're making more now under S21 than we would have under the old one. But it's my impression that the issue was progressivity. In other words, the issue was, as the price of oil goes up, does the state get a bigger share of the taxes? And that's what industry wanted rid of, because they wanted to be able to pocket that money, and they would say reinvest it. And so when the price of oil goes down, I'm not really sure that we're making out worse. We might even be making out better.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. I don't think anybody looked at it going the other way. And
well, I will talk to Scott, because
that'd be a great program.
Yeah, we'll do that, Danny. And thanks for the idea.
Thank you.
All right, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $10 million to nonprofit organizations benefiting everything from Alaska's youth to the arts to healthcare. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive and well in Alaska. So come on, Alaska, warm your heart by sharing your PFD. Pick, click, give. This message on Alaska Public Media comes from ExxonMobil.
Alaska Pacific University now offers the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. More at 1-800-272-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
It's Talk of Alaska, and as is the tradition on our last show of the year, we talk about the news of the year gone by before we push ourselves on ahead into the issues of the new year. And there's so many ways we could go. I've got the pleasure of having a conversation with a history professor. Steve Haycox is with us, and he's been on the show a number of times. It's always a pleasure, and
thank you.
He's one that looks at these present issues, but also has the background of what they happened up against, which can be illuminating for all of us. Because even in my short time in Alaska, there are so many things that have repeated. You say, like one of the callers brought up, you know, how will this be like 86 or will this be like 1991? Mm-hmm. And that's a good question.
Great question.
And I remember when I was talking with Tony Knowles, the former governor, about coming on to defend S-21, which he took a position that he did defend it, but we never did get it together for him to come on the show. But he said, look, you know, I lived through that when oil prices went down to the single digits. You know, that'll throw the fear of God into you when you're a governor, let me tell you that.
Indeed, indeed.
Tony, I can see how that would be. That would give you a few gray hairs. 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. And email is talk@alaskapublic.org. And let's see, Catherine McCarthy. Catherine comes in with, hey, here's a big one, the National Guard sex abuse scandal. Yep, it's in the top 10. And it's probably, we are still waiting. Alaska Public Media is in a legal action to get a look at those internal memoranda, and they've been so heavily redacted right now that we don't really, we can't really get a good picture. We can't get a good fix on it right now.
Alaska has some serious, serious social challenges ahead. Not just the way that the frontier mentality reinforces the notion that somehow men have special rights to knock women around and to take advantage of them. But the whole issue of domestic abuse and spousal abuse in Native communities and the abuse of Native women, these are big challenges that go to the Alaska identity. And so they're intractable in a way, and to change the attitudes that lie underneath the manifestation of that behavior is a big challenge, and Alaska has to take it on. There's unfinished business there that we have to take on.
There's also the question of when someone tries to blow the whistle and what happens to them. It's kind of a hangover, I guess you would say, of the culture. But I always have a lot of sympathy for those people who go ahead and stick their necks out and say, look, this is really happening. You need to do something about this. And nobody does. And they come to us lots of times in the media and we say, well, you don't quite have the story for us here. It's not quite all together. And it's very maddening and frustrating for them. And meanwhile, there are people that are like out to get them, you know, want to destroy their reputations, you know, want to, I mean, people do get penalized. They pay a heavy price. And they usually are warned about that when they get started. But sometimes they just can't keep themselves from doing it, and thank God for it.
Thank God for it. And one of the big international stories this year is the number of journalists who have lost their lives in trying to cover news that might not otherwise get out. A little bit different from the whistleblower syndrome, but related. The courage that it takes to step up and try to tell the truth is not always rewarded.
Well, I did notice in the court agreement with Noble Drilling, buried somewhere in the middle of the story was the fact that $500,000 had to be paid by Noble to the whistleblower.
Yeah.
And I thought, all right, yeah, there's one.
Indeed.
Let's go to Ken, joins the program from Valdez. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Ken.
Hey, the snow capital of the world, calling in.
Well, how much snow do you have right now?
We're just starting to get dumped on. Actually, we've probably got less than 2 feet, which is really amazing. My.
I can't even picture Valdez in the winter like that.
Yeah, we're looking at January and February, so we could fill up pretty quick. And it's done it before, you know, in February one time, I think we got 90 inches in a week or something.
Yeah.
So it's a deep place. But, hey, you guys are talking deep things. I thought I'd throw something out for the listening audience. Hopefully there's people out there that can agree that we need to quit sending money to different places. And I wonder if anybody over there in your little group there knows how much money we give to the UN every year.
I honestly don't. I really don't.
Well, somebody on the television the other day was saying, well, we give millions to the UN, and the guy that was in charge of the situation says, no, we're giving billions. And so I don't know how many billions, but I sure would like to see something rise up against saying, you know, what does the UN do for us? And if we were to take that money, put half of it towards our deficit and half of it towards programs to help small businesses get loans, think about how America would jump forward just getting rid of the UN tail dragger, so to say. So I'm trying to encourage people to think about how we can do that.
Okay, I'm not really sure that it's a substantial part of the federal budget or deficit, though, I'll have to say.
You got to dig in. Find out how much money was sent to the UN this year, and then maybe somebody can spark on it for realizing that that's money that just should be going to the American people instead of some group that's trying to do something. I don't believe they're doing their job.
Yeah, there are two issues there, it seems to me. One is I don't think that it's a substantial part of the federal budget, as Steve suggests. I think when you get the numbers on both what we send to the UN and what we send in foreign aid around the world, you'll find out that it's pretty low percentages, way down in the low single digits. And the other issue is that we need an international organization that helps out when you've got people dying of malaria that don't need to, when you've got people dying of diarrhea that don't need to, when you've got a world health crisis like the Ebola epidemic.
But you got to stop here for a second. I mean, where is Americans that are in tent cities? 15,000 are in Detroit right now. 20,000 in San Francisco, about 9,000 tent living people on the streets. And we're sending money to these places. How about getting the homestead a little bit firmed up before we start sending money to places that probably want to kill us?
They're not exclusive,
you know,
are they?
Hamas is one of them, and all sorts of stuff. You could go on and on. With education, our politicians could really say, let's get this place together in 2015 and quit giving money to places that don't need it.
All right, Ken. I think I know what your issue is. Yeah, thank you very much for your call.
And let's quit playing this little game with all the terrorists. I mean, we aren't terrorists. Americans aren't terrorists. You know, we're supposed to be walking and helping our neighbor, yes, but not giving everything away that just because there's money to give. Let's give it to the American people, help new businesses get going. Come on. Somebody say yes.
All right, Ken. All right. Thank you. Let's go to Roger, joins the program from Eagle River. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Roger.
Thank you very much, Dave. Can you hear me okay?
Just fine.
Okay, good. I'd like Professor Haycox and perhaps you to comment on situation at least I find ourselves in. I think Alaska has made a lot of good choices that alleviate some of the issues that we confront when we have these ups and downs in the economy. We've established a permanent fund. We have money in the budget reserve account. And yes, I know politically those are difficult, but if those wisely used are wisely used and the political will is there, we can weather these kinds of things. Remember, this permanent fund was sold as a rainy day fund, and some of us would think things are raining right now. If you would comment on that, I'm going to hang up. Thank you.
Okay, Roger. Boy, you gave us a clear field there. We could run this one all the way into the end zone. Steve Haycox, why don't you start?
Well, I think the caller is absolutely correct. We have done a good job of managing the money. We perhaps could have done it differently and better. People look to Norway and say, look what they've done with their oil revenue. But we've done a good job, and Clem Tillion points out today, as he has often, that we're the envy of most of the world on our fisheries policy, that we rescued a fishery that was going down into the bottom of the ocean, if you will, and now it's one of the healthiest on the planet.
There's a historian talking right there, because many would say, well, that's because so many of our stocks are wild. But the fact of the matter is that you can look at king crab, you can look at salmon runs. These were depleted runs when statehood came around.
Yeah, they were on the way to extinction. And as Chilean points out in his piece today, it was only through courageous action, telling people, no, you cannot take all of those fish. We're going to save some of them for the future, which people did not want to hear. That put that fishery back where it is now. At least that's part of it. It's hardly the whole management program, but that was an essential piece of it. So we have done a good job. But both Scott Goldsmith and Roger Marks have floated ideas about how we can do still better. Scott has been talking about limiting our state expenditures annually for quite some time, and in that way perpetuating the good things that we've done. It's hard for the legislature to do that, but I think it'll be easier this year, obviously. Cataclysm has a way of focusing people's attention on what they need to think about. So we still have big challenges, and surely the way into the future is not to rob the permanent fund if we can avoid it, and to think about investing state money in the future in some different ways than just taking it out of the permanent fund.
I don't know how this one ever gets off of the dime, Steve Haycox. I just don't know. Frank Murkowski tried mightily to have a summit conference up in Fairbanks in the dead of winter, and what would happen but a big thaw hit. And somehow Frank Murkowski just used up his credibility. He was not able to really attain a consensus there to say, okay, here's what we can do. We have all these funds. We need to integrate this into some kind of approach that leads us to some kind of sustainable future. He was unable to do it. One of the reasons is that there's a $4.6 billion right now, I think, in what they call the earnings reserve of the permanent fund. This does not go into your dividend. This is money that just sits there because everybody's scared to touch it, and it keeps getting more and more. And I don't really, it's just this strange sacred cow that exists in this weird fiscal limbo of some sort, because nobody dares to touch it. It's a total absurdity. We really can't afford to be, you know, letting that money sit around like that. Of course, it does get invested. It does yield. And so it just continues to make the same account bigger. But nobody knows what to do with that. And then there's the question of, well, the constitutional budget reserve. Okay, so now we have a constitutionally protected fund, which untold billions in that one, and that one takes a supermajority to get into. So they'll probably get a consensus in the legislature to tap into that one, I would think. They probably won't do anything with the permanent fund earnings reserve because people would squawk bloody murder, thinking they were taking their dividends away when they weren't. Directly the opposite. And then there's the other reserve.
Statutory budget.
That they can just take whatever they want out of. So I'm sure they'll dip into that one big time.
That'll go first.
But meanwhile, you have all these capital projects, and it looks like there will be some exertion of control on that. And one can only imagine as the departments start looking at things and as the public chimes in. I have some confidence that the public actually will have some ideas that will amount to something here.
Well, we'll see. The legislature has an impermeability when it comes to listening to the general public, it seems to me, sometimes. But as I say, cataclysm has a way of focusing attention, and so this is going to be a very interesting legislative year, it seems to me.
Well, and if the administration is able to make something that gets a lot of public participation out of that website thing that they're trying to do and seriously goes to hearings and so forth like that, it could step up the pressure.
Let's wait and see.
We will wait and see. And meanwhile, another budget has to go to the legislature next month.
Yeah.
Well, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. If subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing are important to you, please consider applying for one of 35 seats open on your Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Councils. The seats will be filled by rural Alaskans who are knowledgeable about fish and wildlife resources in their region. Apply by January 23, 2015. Information at 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence at fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
As we said, it depends on where you are. From Kodiak, G. Patterson chimes in and says, hey, we had a rocket explode here. It's pretty big news. And the funding is greatly in doubt about the whole Kodiak launch complex. A very good point. And we'll go to Matt in Sitka in a moment. But Professor Haycox, I think we ought to probably reflect on one we did a talk of Alaska with on, and that is the absorption of the Anchorage Daily News by the Alaska Dispatch.
Seems to me that Alaska is, as a result of Alice Rogoff and the work that she and her team did, is in the catbird seat. It looks like Alaska is out there in front on capturing the new technology and turning it into a serviceable source of information for the general public. I think the Dispatch story is one of the big stories of this year because if you think back to the beginning of this year and back to last year, everybody was saying, oh, print journalism is going down the drain and we don't know what's going to happen. And then there was a huge amount of ambiguity. Now we have this news source that people are relying on. It's got energetic investigative journalism, a lot of fine reporters, good leadership from Tony Hofsinger. It seems to me that we've come out of that looking pretty good.
When we had Tony in here with Alice Rogoff, Tony said, well, we have realized it does count to be able to put it on paper.
A lot of people still want to feel it tactically.
I thought that was absolutely priceless. Let's go to Matt, joins the program from Sitka. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Matt.
Oh, Happy New Year, Steve. Thank you very much. One of the main stories here locally is the is our Blue Lake Dam. We just completed it, and for the tune, it depends on who you talk to, of $158 million. Which was not the anticipated cost when I started that project. Some people reported as $145 million. But it reflects the story around the state. We just, on the 24th of December, in a front-page story in the local paper, the city tore the pavement up on a road because they can't, a city road, because they didn't have the money to do the substructure and then repave it. I think the total cost for that in town, which needs to be done, is something like $24 million, and the city doesn't have that. So now they're tearing up the pavement and laying down gravel. on a road that, you know, have for 20 years or more have been paved.
That is so Alaskan.
It may be so Alaskan, but it's a really a disturbing trend. And part of that is the decline of population in Southeast Alaska and regional areas, and the population moving to South Central, you know, the Wasilla, Palmer, and Anchorage. And it's a loss of revenue, a loss of income to these local communities. It's really disturbing for me that communities outside of the rail belt are struggling so much, and we have on top of that this you know crash in the oil prices, which the state depends on. I'm personally, as a commercial fisherman, happy to see the price of oil go down, but as an Alaska resident, I'm very nervous about funding for infrastructure around the rest of the state. I think that's a really big issue. The state of Alaska last year spent $35 million on a Susitna Dam study, and the year before that, they spent $100 million. Didn't give $1 to the Blue Lake project here in Sitka. So anyway, that's the big thing here in Sitka, that money for infrastructure, harbors, roads, and a hydro plant, which doesn't endanger any fish. There's no fish on that system, so because it's a vertical drop way above the salt water. Anyway, I just wanted to run that by you.
All right.
That's happening in this part of rural Alaska. Thank you very much. Happy New Year.
Yeah, Matt, and thank you for that field note from Sitka. I will say that the numbers show that Southeast has hit bottom and is coming back a bit. It's no longer losing population.
If you count Juneau,
if
you take Juneau out of the mix, they're all moving to Juneau in Southeast. Juneau's experiencing what the rail belt area is experiencing, you know, with particularly Anchorage, South Central area is experiencing. The population is going up in Juneau, going down everywhere else, maybe slightly up in Ketchikan, but the other communities are losing population, according to the latest stuff from Department of Labor and that annual report or that monthly report they put out.
Oh,
thank
good.
You very much.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for the enlightenment on that one, Matt. Professor Haycox, this one comes from Randy. It's another softball for you. I wonder if Professor Haycox could comment on the University of Alaska in light of President Gamble's upcoming retirement and the program prioritization at UAA.
Well, the university's being hit just like the rest of the state with funding issues, and I'm glad I don't have to deal with it. I have sympathy for the people who are dealing with it. I'm not sure that their priorities are the same as my priorities, but I'm not running things, so.
Well, I'll chime in this much. I think there's always a tendency to look at it, when you look at education as an investment and you don't think of the quality of life investment, you start losing humanities and liberal arts and critical thinking and things like that for the sake of career. Essentially that you can do that in educational system, but that's not all education is about.
Seems to me that the state has to think about human capital, and this state invests very little in the development of human capital, and it's a tragedy, it seems to me, because the future really rests on what you invest in human capital.
And we're going to go back to that one on the show, I can assure you, in the coming year.
Terrific. Good.
Alex Hills is going to insist on it.
Terrific.
Let's go to Juneau and John. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, John.
Hello. Very interesting program, Steve. I've got a cataclysm that I wish would focus more people's attention, but it's a slow-moving one, and maybe it isn't focusing. At least it wasn't a one of your 10 stories.
Yeah.
And that's climate change.
Hmm. Yeah, because it's hard to find
a real awkward position there.
Yeah, it's hard to find a focus and say, okay, well, here is the story, because it's such an issue that touches on so many different things. But it is an enormous issue.
Yeah, I mean, we do talk about the effects that we're feeling here. The ocean acidification is a huge one. And shoreline erosion that's taken out villages and stuff like that. But it's real hard to start looking inward at our own responsibility as a petrostate. And yikes, where are we going with that? You know, do we want to start adapting to a fossil alternative energy future as a matter of our own conscience, or do we want it forced down our throats by desperate people around the world, you know? I don't need to go any further. If you'd like to talk about it on the air, I'll get off.
All right,
but
yeah,
I do
thank
wish
you.
We were talked about more.
Thank you, John. And yeah, petrostate is the word, I think.
Well, and I took heart from the fact that there's a little international help coming. Pope Francis mentioned climate change in his end of the year address. So both he and President Obama, at least, are thinking about how do we get the general public to begin to think about this issue.
It would be nice, maybe someday, to see Alaska lead in some respect or other. We're trying on alternative energy. I will say that.
Yeah,
we are trying. There is movement. Sometimes it's a little hard to see day to day, but there is movement. Greg and Juno, I think you'll be our last caller. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Oh, welcome, Steve. How you doing?
Just good.
I'd like to talk about, you know, the oil prices look like they're going to be down for a while, so it may be time to think about some alternate forms of revenue. It's going to be down for a while, I think, mainly because the supply isn't being bought up by the Chinese, and the Saudis and us are squeezing the Russians' economy with the oil.
Okay, anyway, well, you got 30 seconds. What do you propose?
The revenue. Build a refinery, some refineries here for the jobs and cheaper gas, and have the governor get off his duff about the commercial selling of the pot that was legalized. Two big revenue generators. I'll listen off the air. Thanks.
Okay, yeah, well, there we are. We lost a refinery. Do you think there's any hope of a more value added on our petroleum products?
Not at the moment. Not until we see an uptick in the price and more energy coming from the investors.
And in the next year, I'm not really thinking there's going to be a whole lot of income from any kind of marijuana industry. Maybe I'm wrong.
I'd be surprised, though.
But it's still going to be fun.
I assume that there'll be people who will have a high lot of fun on that.
Professor Haycox, always a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me. It is a pleasure for me.
It's Talk of Alaska, and we've been talking the year gone by and the prospects for the year to come. Thanks so much to Monica Gokey, Josh Edge, and Evan Erickson today. I'm Steve Heimel. Thank you for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Federal Subsistence Board meeting is Wednesday, January 21st through Friday, January 23rd, 2015 at the Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center in Anchorage. The meeting is open to the public either in person or by teleconference. Public comments and input on the proposed changes to federal subsistence fish and shellfish regulations is being sought, along with specific fisheries proposals. Meeting materials found at regulations.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.